This is the story that is disturbing.
She has a nervous breakdown. She's exploding. You can call it D-book.
When a woman is 40 years old and she's not married and she doesn't have any kids, society will push her to the corner.
This idea that a D-book punishing woman for her desire was a cautionary tale which was very popular in the Jewish tradition.
The D-book was written just over a century ago and has become the most iconic play in the entire canon of Jewish drama. It is a story of possession, a Jewish exorcism, and asks, can love conquer death? The D-book has inspired Hollywood movies, a Leonard Bernstein ballet, operas, and countless stage productions. Like Shakespeare's great works, it is reimagined every generation. On today's Cafe International, we'll look at the history and the music of this remarkable play, speak with actresses who have played the leading role, Leia, and look at a sensational new version of the D-book by Israel's Gesher Theatre that opens September 29th at Toronto's Elgin Theatre. The play confronts arranged marriage and asks, why do some consider an unmarried, childless woman to be possessed? The D-book was written in Russia between 1913 and 1916 by journalist and playwright S. Onsky. Anna Sternschuss is a professor of Jewish studies at the University of Toronto.
So Onsky was born under the name Shloima Zimbel Rapoport in 1863.
In 1912, Onsky set out on a two-year expedition to small Jewish villages in Russia and Ukraine to collect folklore, music, and stories.
Onsky wanted to preserve the wealth of culture of Jewish people because he believed that he was the last generation witnessing this culture.
Composer Frank London of the Klezmatics.
So what they did is they went from town to town, village to village, settle to settle, and talked to people and got them to tell stories and got them to sing songs, and they recorded them. Premonition that the world was changing so fast that these stories and these songs were not going to survive.
Gabriella Safran is a professor of Jewish studies at Stanford University and the author of Wandering Soul, the D-book's creator, S. Onsky.
He brought along a musicologist, a photographer, sometimes other people, and they traveled around the shtetls.
Gesher Theater playwright, Roy Chen.
So he collected stories, jokes, rituals from those shtetls, from those small Jewish villages all around Russia and Ukraine. And one of the stories was a story about a young bride who shouted under the chuppah in her marriage ceremony, shouted in a male voice to her groom, "You are not my husband." She was possessed by a spirit of a dead person, which is a D-book in Jewish mythology.
He began writing a play based on a lot of the material he collected. The play is called The D-book. And the play is about possession, and it's set in a shtetl. Sometimes I tell people it's like a cross between The Exorcist and Fiddler on the Roof.
D-book, Leia falls in love with Hanan, a young scholar. He dies unexpectedly. Her father plots an arranged marriage to a much wealthier man, but Leia becomes possessed by the spirit of the deceased Hanan on her wedding day, and as a result, the community organizes an exorcism. Gabriella Safran.
So Onsky, as he wrote the D-book, he was inspired by the folklore he was collecting on the expeditions, and he was also inspired, I believe, by another experience he had in 1913, which is that he attended the Bayliss trial, an event that happened in 1913 when a Jewish man in Kiev, Mendel Bayliss, was accused of capturing and killing a Christian child to use his blood to make matzah.
While Mendel Bayliss was eventually acquitted of the murder of a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy, the blood libel, The accusation that Jews killed children for ritual purposes fueled anti-Semitism at the time, a period when thousands of Jews were murdered during pogroms in Eastern Europe.
Onsky, as a journalist, attended the Bayless trial and found it very depressing and horrible. And I think there's a trace of that kind of pessimism and a sense of maybe that there's no easy solution for the Jews, that no one will come and rescue them. I think that kind of very dark feeling underlies the Dybbuk.
Again, Professor Anna Sternschuss.
Onsky, like many other contemporaries of his time, was shaken by the magnitude of pogroms, of anti-Jewish riots. Most of them were actually initiated by people who lived around Jews, or the government didn't do anything to stop the pogroms, so historians understand that the pogroms are something that the government didn't really prevent, although it could. He believed that with all this violence, people don't get to tell their story. He also worried that this would be the last generation of Jews in Eastern Europe. He didn't know that the worst was yet to come, that the pogroms that would devastate the community between 1917 and 1920, and that's when the word Holocaust actually started being used for the first time because of the catastrophe.
One of the main themes in the Dybbuk is what happens to the memory and the soul of a life cut short. As a result, the centuries-old idea of a Dybbuk, a ghost, who its victims were, and how to cure someone who was possessed, began to change.
One of the worst things that can happen to a soul after a person dies is that it doesn't find eternal place. The Dybbuk is the soul that cannot find rest, or it really doesn't want to go to hell, and it finds ways to avoid that. So after dying, the Dybbuk is a sort of a substance that hangs out close to the mikveh, the ritual bath, because it thinks that in the ritual bath, where a person goes there naked and immerses herself before she has sexual intercourse with her husband or before her wedding, so this is the moment when she's open, when she's vulnerable, and that's the moment when the Dybbuk can enter her body. And in the Middle Ages, the whole story of Dybbuk happened usually to young, innocent women who would go to the mikveh before their wedding, the night before their wedding, and they would be filled with lust for their husband or for, you know, lust for sex. And they would be thinking about this, and that's the moment of vulnerability when the Dybbuk would enter their body. And that's when all the trouble started. And then the woman would come out and she would speak with a man's voice. Usually a Dybbuk was a male spirit, and she was not herself. That led to a lot of beliefs and customs. For example, a woman is always guarded at the mikvah. So there was always, until today actually, there is a woman who watches her going into the mikvah because she's guarding the Dybbuk not to leave her alone.
Historically, the Dybbuk's victims were almost exclusively women.
The explanation for this is that in the Middle Ages, one of the biggest fears people had was of women's desires. If a woman wants something, if a woman really wants something, that was scary. And it's not an accident that strong women, women who are powerful, are portrayed as witches. This idea that a Dybbuk punishing woman for her desire was a cautionary tale, which was very popular in the Jewish tradition. Another way is to think about who becomes a Dybbuk and how you deal with mental illness. Because it's one thing is to say the devil is in you, but it's also, and that's how people understood the mental illness in the past, but say Dybbuk is in you is also very interesting because it takes the blame on the person a little bit. Throughout the Jewish history, who can Dybbuk enter and who becomes a Dybbuk changed. So at first, the Dybbuk is the one who didn't believe in God much. Then it changes to the one who didn't observe Shabbat, or a person who's smoking on Shabbat or something. And then it's like 18th century, a person who didn't give enough to charity became a Dybbuk. So it's interesting how they were punished for this. This belief that the Dybbuk enters a body of a vulnerable person, especially a woman who wants something, that did not change for quite a bit. Onsky recorded so many beliefs like that Dybbuk.
The idea of who became a Dybbuk also changed at the time Onsky wrote the play.
In the early 20th century, the meaning of Dybbuk also began to change because so many Jews were dying from violent causes that this unrested soul thing was somebody who didn't finish their business on earth. And that's something that Dybbuk always was. But the reason why that business is not finished changed because of violent death. So somebody was killed and they didn't finish. And that's why they cannot find eternal rest, and they're wondering and they're trying to find someone who can finish that business for them. And we see that happening first a little bit in the 17th century after the Khmelnytsky's massacre of 1648, but really a lot in the early 20th century in the aftermath of pogroms. So Dybbuk is no longer such an evil spirit, but a lost spirit, as somebody whose memory will disappear unless that creature enters somebody's body. And Onsky, I think, was really fascinated by that idea. The spirit of the civilization that was disappearing very quickly in front of his eyes, to capture that in the form of Dybbuk. That's what he was doing. He was taking the unrested spirit of Jewish culture and tradition of East European Jews and put it into the modern body of a theater.
Onsky originally wrote the Dybbuk in Russian and then translated it into Yiddish. He died in 1920 at the age of 57, just before the play premiered in Yiddish in Warsaw. Again, Onsky biographer Gabriela Safran.
Onsky got to experience audiences' reactions to his own reading of the play, but he never got to see it performed by a troupe. It was only performed by the Vilna troupe a month after he died for the Shloshim, for the 30-day anniversary of his death.
2 years later, in 1922, the Dybbuk was staged in Moscow by the Habima Theater, the start of what became a historic run. Haaretz theater critic Michael Handelsaltz.
It was casting a giant shadow on Israeli theater, and it remained in the repertoire of the Habima until 60s, for almost 40 years. Hanna Rovina, the original Lea in the Habima performance, which she played when she was already 32, and the character is 14 years old, she played the part until late 50s.
The Dybbuk, originally based on the music and stories Onsky collected during his expeditions to gather folklore, quickly became the most iconic and arguably the most important play in the history of Jewish drama. The music we have been hearing is from Voretsky Pass, based on folk music in Eastern Europe from the period of Onsky's expeditions. In 1937, in Poland, the Dybbuk was turned into a feature film in Yiddish. Again, University of Toronto professor Anna Sternschis.
They made this film in Poland. Poland had a booming Yiddish film industry in the 30s, and the Dybbuk was mostly made for the American audience, American Yiddish-speaking audience. That's where market was for this stuff. It's interesting to think about what Dybbuk means in that context. One, for American audience, this whole Polish Yiddish culture is a lost civilization. They are watching the films with nostalgia to the world of their parents and their grandparents that they know will never come back. So the Yiddish film Dybbuk is filled with stuff that a normal filmmaker would never put in the movie. For example, it features a 10-minute long dance at the wedding with some special moves and all this. It features a long worship in the synagogue. So this whole Dybbuk film was a nostalgic exercise for American viewers. Having said that, just a few years later, as we know, so the film was made in 1937, by 1942, the majority of Polish Jews were dead. Yiddish-speaking Jews were dead. So the actors who played in Dybbuk were dead. Most of the people involved were dead. So the film itself became their Dybbuk. They became a spirit that disturbs us and doesn't let us forget about what happened. And it's interesting how in the film itself, in the final scene, Leia hears the voice of a Dybbuk that's expelled from her body. And she asks him, "Who are you?" And he says, "I don't know who I am, but whatever you remember about me will survive." This is what the Dybbuk said, because once the Dybbuk is expelled, the Dybbuk loses their memory and identity. So for that film of 1937, the Dybbuk was no longer a scary spirit. The Dybbuk was the memory of the civilization that's gone. And thinking how this film was made in 1937 and told us this, just few short years before this whole Polish Yiddish civilization would be gone, is really nothing short of prophetic.
Coming up next, part two of our report on the Dybbuk, a tale that seems to shape every generation of Jewish and popular culture. Leonard Bernstein created a Dybbuk ballet. Marilyn Lightstone electrified audiences with her portrayal of Leah in the 1970s, and later, how Israel's Gesher Theater reinvented the play for the 21st century. In 1974, composer Leonard Bernstein collaborated with ballet master Harold Robbins to create a ballet based on Anski's Dybbuk. Conductor Andrew Mogrelia later revived the ballet in San Francisco in 2005.
I think he and Jerome Robbins, they were fascinated by the story. They were both slightly mercurial characters. The idea of this Jewish story of this Dybbuk, this otherworldly being coming back to haunt a figure, I suspect it probably resonated with both of them. And they thought about it for decades before Bernstein actually started composing it.
In the Dybbuk story, the character of Hanan wants to study Kabbalah, the ancient Jewish mysticism. Kabbalah also influenced Leonard Bernstein's composition. Professor Anna Sternschuss.
Kabbalah is a trend in Judaism that started sometime in the Middle Ages. And the idea was that every letter of Torah has hidden power. And if a person is learned enough to understand that hidden power, they can actually use it in order to achieve some practical results in the world where they live. So it's as close to magic as Judaism ever got. So, according to Jewish law, only men who reach the age of 40 are allowed to even study that. So I think what Hanan, who's in the play, of course, much younger than 40, but who's very smart and very learned, and Hanan is playing with Kabbalah in order to get something that he knows that there's no other way he can get, and that is to get Leah to marry him. And in the process, he accidentally dies, because Kabbalah is very dangerous. If you unlock the power of these letters, they can kill you.
This score is a highly unusual score of Leonard Bernstein's. He rarely wrote music like this, but at some point he consciously decided that he was going to create a score with a very Jewish theme, and he was going to somehow manufacture and compose the music with a Jewish influence. And he chose the Kabbalistic tree. And in the Kabbalistic tradition, each letter of the Hebrew alphabet has a numerical value. So he decided to look at the characters in the ballet, and the lead female character, Leah, L-E-A-H, the letters of her name in this Kabbalistic tradition, they all add up to 36.
The numerical value of the word life in Hebrew, chai, is 18. And that's why Jews traditionally give charity in monetary number that could be divided by 18. Another number that's super important in Jewish tradition is number 36. Because there is a belief that there are 36 righteous people living in the world somewhere. They're hidden saints. Hasidim used to say that tzaddikim, but the belief is much older than Hasidism. And the belief is that those 36 righteous people live their lives in such a way that the world continues to exist. In Judaism, these 36 people are marked with letters. Letter Lamed is 30, letter Vav is 6, so they're called Lamed Vavniks. And if Leah indeed means 36 in Hebrew, there could be some sort of hint that she's one of those hidden saints.
So much of the music derives using numbers 36 and 18 and 9. So that's sometimes rhythmic, so a linear use of numbers and rhythms, and sometimes it's a melodic use in scales.
This is The Exorcism from Leonard Bernstein's ballet, The Dybbuk, with the Nashville Symphony, conducted by Andrew Mogrelia. Early 1970s, Onsky's Dybbuk had begun to fade from public attention. In 1975, a new version of the play, directed by John Hirsch and starring Marilyn Lightstone, drew praise from audiences and critics alike. The New York Times wrote, "While Macbeth with Charlton Heston and Vanessa Redgrave is the current hot-ticket attraction despite unfavorable reviews, the real theatrical excitement, however, is next door, where a daring new production of S. Onsky's The Dybbuk is being given its premiere." The New York Times went on to describe the Dybbuk as a rarely performed play drawn from 19th century East European Jewish folklore. Marilyn Lightstone, in the demanding role of Leia, deserves special praise. Her performance has a depth of feeling that gives the play its overwhelming impact. Actress Marilyn Lightstone on what it was like playing Leia, and also Leia possessed by a ghost, a male Dybbuk, in 1975.
I kind of let myself be guided by my voice. I've been very fortunate in that I have a big vocal, and I can speak very, very deep. And I can also speak very high. So there would not be a Dybbuk as another character hovering around me or above me or below me or dancing. I was a girl who was possessed by a Dybbuk, and the Dybbuk made itself known through the Dybbuk's voice, and the Dybbuk's voice came out of my mouth. So that determined an awful lot. If you suddenly find yourself, I mean, just think, wake up in the morning and suddenly you speak with a voice and it's not your own voice. And you just have to, as a performer, say, yes, that's the case, and I believe this. You know, for the duration of this production, I believe that this is someone else's voice coming out of me. Was she a victim, or was she enacting something that she really wanted to? Did she bring this on? Who knows? Who knows? As far as myself as an actress was concerned, I was possessed by a Dybbuk.
The character of Leia in the Dybbuk is one of the greatest and most demanding female roles ever written for the stage, portraying the gamut of human emotions, the passion of reuniting with a true love, the mental illness of possession, the fear of an abusive father, and the perseverance to choose one's own path. One of the most memorable parts of the play is when Leia is forced to undergo an exorcism to remove the spirit of her true love, Hanan, from her. An onstage rabbinical exorcism is something few actresses get to experience. Again, Marilyn Lightstone.
It was wonderful! Well, you know, the exorcism, first of all, there's a big battle with the rabbi because, you know, Leia's taken to the great wonder rabbi who is known performing all these miracles to exorcise her and thereby cure her, depending on which, you know, version you want to believe. And so it's a battle. It's a battle between the Dybbuk and the rabbi. And in this case, the great wonder rabbi fails. He does not exorcise the Dybbuk, so therefore they have to perform the exorcism ceremony, in which is held in the synagogue and is held with all the ram's horns blowing. What, Tahiya, Karu? I can't remember the names of all the different calls on the ram's horn. And it was kind of sensational. It was very exciting. I mean, to be lying there on the floor possessed and be surrounded by all these elderly men and to lacing, blowing ram's horns. It was tremendously dramatic and thrilling production to be involved in as a totally young actress, but kind of a youngish actress. And it's not the kind of experience you're going to get in most acting roles. Most of the things that we get to play, particularly women, are very limited in scope. So to get something that's like completely outside of that world, it's like someone just handed you a great big present. You just unwrap the ribbons and untake the wrapping paper with great relish.
One of the traditions that Anski documented in his folkloric expeditions and featured in the Dybbuk play is the Jewish exorcism, a custom that has a long and troubling history. Again, Professor Anna Sternches.
Judaism has a lot of problems with women's desires. The whole way that the system is set up is that a woman has to channel her desires towards raising her children. And if she wants other things, that could lead to trouble. I think Dybbuk is a reflection of that. And it's also interesting how you get rid of a Dybbuk. You can't just get rid of a Dybbuk by wanting to get rid of the Dybbuk. You need a group of rabbis who perform some sort of exorcism on you. And what often happened is that they would show fire to the Dybbuk or even burn the Dybbuk. And as you can imagine, you know, how do you burn the Dybbuk exactly? You burn the part of the human body for which that Dybbuk entered. So a lot of people died in the process of extortion's Dybbuk, and they would say, oh, but at least now she's free of Dybbuk. This whole thing about why Dybbuk enters women, it's easier to kill a woman in the process of treating a woman. The modern medicine was not kind to women. Until today, women's pain is not taken as seriously as it should be. This whole idea of rabbis exercising powers of helping a woman and getting rid of the Dybbuk, that story was perfect in so many ways because it denigrated women's pain and it gave tremendous power to rabbis.
We're going to hear more music inspired by the Dybbuk, this time from the Klezmatics, from the score of the 1997 stage adaptation by Tony Kushner. Klezmatics trumpetist Frank London.
Just living in that world, through this play, we get a sense of this pre-modern Jewish world from the 19th century, and I think that is what is so delicious about the Dybbuk. Thank you.
That was The Klezmatics with Dybbuk Shares. When we come back, the conclusion of our report on the Dybbuk. Israel's famed Gesher Theater has transformed the play for the 21st century into a psychological drama, raising questions about arranged marriage and mental illness. The North American premiere is September 29th at Toronto's Elgin Theater. In recent decades, the Dybbuk has shaped numerous Hollywood films. The Coen brothers' A Serious Man from 2009. Ghost, starring Demi Moore, Whoopi Goldberg, and Patrick Swayze in 1990.
If anything, if I could just touch you once more.
Says he wishes he was alive again so he could touch you.
Me too.
And more recently, 2012's The Possession.
This movie was inspired by a true story about the people who actually found a Dybbuk box. And then all sorts of weird things started happening.
Composer Ofer Ben-Amotz wrote a Dybbuk chamber opera in 2008.
Leah has to decide if she's staying between life or death. Is she going back to life and marrying somebody that she doesn't like and doesn't know? Or is she staying and dying and joining her beloved Hanan?
Now, the play is back in the headlines with Israel's Gesher Theater that has rewritten Onsky's classic for modern audiences. The Gesher Theater was founded in Israel in 1991 by Yevgeny Arieh. Israeli playwright Roy Han.
Yevgeny Arieh, the founder and artistic director of Gesher Theater, came to Israel with a group of actors. Nobody spoke a word in Hebrew, and they made a revolution in Israeli theater.
Arieh was born in Moscow in 1947, which is where he began his theatrical career. In 1980, he tried to leave the Soviet Union to pursue artistic and religious freedom. Yevgeny Arieh.
I decided to leave Moscow much earlier, in 1980, but I got refused. So for 10 years I was refusing. We were refuseniks.
University of Toronto professor Anna Sternches.
The Soviet government put more obstacles for Jews to go on tours because they were worried that Jews would stay.
It was like I was a traitor, that I betrayed the whole system. It was with everybody. Nobody could continue to work after we applied to leave the country.
As a result of that, there was a group of people called refuseniks. That's how they were called in English, refused exit visas. Once a person applied for an exit visa and they said that they want to go for permanent residence somewhere else, they were often fired from their positions at work.
By the late 1980s, Jews were finally free to leave the Soviet Union. Olga Gershenson is a professor of Jewish studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of Gesher, Russian Theater in Israel.
It was a time in Israel of this tremendous wave of immigration from the late Soviet Union.
Playwright Roy Chen.
A million of people came from the USSR and they changed our society, changed our culture. But Gesher, I think, is one of the great successes of this aliyah.
Professor Olga Gershenson.
And the theater originated from a circle of theater professionals, mainly from leading theaters in Moscow, who came to Israel, and they had professional aspirations.
Haaretz theater critic Michael Handelsaltz.
The actors who came, who studied and worked with Yevgeny Arieh, the artistic director and founder, they came as a performing company of very high standard. The Israeli audience was very much impressed by them, and rightly so.
Today, we cannot imagine the Israeli theater without Gesher.
Gesher quickly became known for their captivating psychological dramas. They then decided to completely remake the Dybbuk. Gesher Theater founder and artistic director, Yevgeny Arieh.
We are not going to do this play like it was written. We changed it a lot. our play Dybbuk is based on this theme, on the play of Anski, but it's a completely different play. It was a huge challenge for us to come back to this material.
Michael Handelsaltz.
Now, in Yevgeny's aria version of the Dybbuk, which is not Anski's play, it's a play by Roy Chen based on the Anski play and on the Habiba performance. There are characters of the dead in the cemetery, which are part of the play and the performance.
Roy Chen.
I approached this material with holy fear. To rewrite a classic is always frightening. But I see the theater as a secular synagogue.
The world of the dead in Yevgeny's play is actually much more, how shall I say it, enticing.
It's not just mystical folklore play. It's a play about very unusual love.
Efrat Ben-Zur is one of Israel's leading actresses of both stage and screen and plays the role of Leah in Gesher's Dybbuk. Playwright Roy Chen wrote his Dybbuk specifically for her and wanted to portray Leah as a 40-year-old, resisting her father's plans for an arranged marriage.
She's not a naive girl. She's not young anymore. She's a woman that's been through a lot of things, and she already rejected a lot of men, and we understand that she preferred to be alone and to be different. And I think Leah deeply recognized intuitively that for her to be married to someone she doesn't want, for her to get to bed and have sex with someone she doesn't want, is a real catastrophe.
I wrote my Dybbuk especially for her. We understood that we're going to base this production on her character, on the way that she looks, on her age.
This is a production for Me Too moment.
Roy Chen.
When a woman is 40 years old and she's not married and she doesn't have any kids, society will push her to the corner.
She has a father that loves her in a very disturbing way.
Actress Efrat Ben-Zur.
She's a feminist in her own way. She does not obey to those voices, to those rules. On her wedding night, she has a nervous breakdown. She's exploding. You can call it Dybbuk, but I see it in a different way. For me, to play Leah is to bring what is really happening to those women that exploding on their wedding night when they're supposed to do something that they're not connected to.
If I lay me, a piece of my feet, why my
While the Dybbuk is a story of the supernatural, of ghosts and possession, a Jewish exorcism, arranged marriages and mental illness, its central message is memory. How do we remember a culture that was lost? How do we remember lives cut short? Gesher Theater General Director Lena Krendlin.
The most important thing what the mother said to her daughter when she came to visit her in the cemetery, she told her, gather your memories, because your memories during your life, it's the only thing you have.
University of Toronto Professor Anna Sternches.
Hanan dies in a play because he is performing some magic on himself, which is prohibited by Jewish law. So his life is cut short, but his love is not over. So that's why he becomes Dybbuk. So many Jewish lives were cut short by violence, first by the pogroms, and then dramatically by the Holocaust, that it seems that if we say, well, dead is dead, it means that somehow we betray the memory and lives of the people whose life and children who were killed for no reason and without any meaning. So the Dybbuk is our story, is a Jewish story of how to make sure that the voices of these people are still there somewhere. It's not an accident that the Dybbuk says, I don't know who I am, and I will only be alive if you remember me. This is something that is the foundation of modern Jewish culture. They don't know who they are, but the truth is we don't know who we are if we don't remember those who were killed during the Holocaust, those who were killed before us, and it is our mission to remember that. And in a very twisted and very kind of strange way, Dybbuk reminds us of that.
The North American premiere of Gesher's Dybbuk is September 29th and 30th at Toronto's Elgin Theatre, presented by Show One Productions. For Cafe International, I'm Dan Rosenberg.